Okay, today our topic is Herod the Great, an individual who to most of us is known only from a very brief mention in the Gospels, because we find the wise men of the East coming to his court and inquiring about where the Messiah was to be born. And of course Herod, when he is tricked by them and is not told of exactly where and when the child was born, takes out this very extreme retaliation that we read about, slaying all the male children in the given area of Bethlehem from 2 years of age and down, according to the time when the men reported that the star had first appeared to them. And that's all we hear about Herod the Great. We hear nothing else about him except that when Joseph and his family was in Egypt, they heard that Herod was dead, and then they came back. And so we know nothing else, at least from the Gospels, about this individual, who is truly one of the major figures of history in the Middle East, somebody that you would not necessarily want to emulate, but somebody who certainly left a deep impact on the shape and direction of the events in the Middle East, and in many ways had great capabilities. Now, that's why he's known as Herod the Great. This is not something he called himself, unlike some others in the 20th century who feel that necessary. But this is what history has decided, that he is entitled to be known as Herod the Great. Indeed, because of these strengths, the Roman Emperor Augustus was at one time known to comment that Herod was the best client king in his entire empire. That he felt he was the strongest and most thoroughly loyal and capable ally that Rome had in the entire empire. To put it back in balance, however, we should also note that Augustus also said on another occasion, "I would rather be Herod's pig than one of his sons." And if you have trouble figuring out that comment, I don't think you will in a little while. Herod was truly a genius in the use of power. He knew how to use it effectively. He certainly was personally courageous when courage was called for. He was probably one of the finest military leaders in the history of the world. I don't know if I'd put him in a league with Napoleon and Julius Caesar and Alexander, but I certainly wouldn't put him far below them, based on his military exploits. He also was somebody who was a superb architect. Augustus, as part of the plan to restore the morale of the Roman people after several generations of civil war, had begun a massive rebuilding program in Rome. And it was said of Augustus, whether it's true or not, of course, is open to question. I don't think you could take this at face value. You have to take it with a grain of salt, as the saying goes. Is that Augustus found Rome a city of brick, and he left it a city of marble. Now, obviously, that's hyperbole, as was common in those days. But still, Augustus built many beautiful buildings in Rome. And they were built out of the finest and costliest marbles and built in exquisite taste. Well, Herod was, of course, I wouldn't call him a servant, but a client of Augustus. He was the one who was behind his position as king of Judea, the one whose favoritism he had to, of course, retain. And so Herod was stimulated to do like Augustus, to engage in massive building projects, not just in Jerusalem and the rest of Judea, but throughout the Middle East. And I'll talk a little more about some of his building projects a little later. Now, if I had to sum up the man, as to what he was like as a person. Certainly the biblical, short biblical description of him as a man who was capable of great cruelty would be accurate. He was a man who was capable of great cruelty. He executed 3 of his sons, his wife, his mother-in-law, and at least one of his very closest friends and associates. When he lay dying of diseases we won't mention here, he was very concerned about the fact that he had been unpopular among his subjects. And it bothered him greatly that they would probably sing and dance and rejoice when they heard he was dead. And so he ordered his soldiers to take captive all the leading men and women in Judea. And they were held in the hippodrome. You know what a hippodrome is? No. A hippodrome, from the Latin hippos, it was the chariot race course in Caesarea. And he had given instructions to the captain of his guard, personal household palace guard, that he should be present with these hostages constantly. And when word was received from Jerusalem that he had died, he was to kill all of these notable men and women. And so he said, "That way I know people will mourn when I die." So as I say, the man was capable of great cruelty. Fortunately for these hostages, this didn't happen. After he was dead, his sister canceled the order, not wanting to see it carried out. But I said, this is what the man was capable of. So on the one side, we see tremendous accomplishments and abilities, not the least of which was the temple in Jerusalem, which he completely rebuilt, and which, for which he was the architect, personally, responsible for its construction and design. And as even the Greek geographer Strabo said, who was no lover of things Jewish, being typical of the Greeks of that period, he said, "If you have not seen the temple of the Jews in Jerusalem, you've never seen a beautiful building in your life." This was no mean achievement, just the building of the temple itself, for which he was the architect. So as I say, a genius in the use of power, a military man of unusual abilities, certainly if not in the absolute top class, somewhat not far below it, and a man of tremendous architectural skill and ability, and yet mixed with cruelty and paranoia. Cruelty and paranoia. Because much of the cruelty came out of his paranoia. I think you know what if you don't know what the word paranoia means, it means an unreasonable fear. You know, a fear for which there is no real foundation. It's really a psychosis. You know, psychologists talk about small disturbances they call neuroses, which, and then they talk about more serious ones that are called psychoses. And I think that many psychologists reading about Herod and his behavior would probably view him as being psychotic at times, especially because of his paranoid feeling. Throughout his reign, from the time he took power in Judea in 37 BC until his death in approximately 4 BC. I say approximately 4 BC because we cannot pinpoint the year with any great certainty. That is the leading guess. And the reason why I say we can't do it with any great certainty is because we know he died after a particular astronomical event. But that astronomical event occurred twice within a few years. And so we're not exactly sure which of those events is the one that preceded his death. So there is a little bit of uncertainty there. But throughout this long reign in Judea, he had 2 major objectives that governed everything that he did. The first was to stay in the good graces of Rome. to stay in the good graces of Rome. In other words, to please the Roman leadership so that he would retain his position. The second of his major objectives was to prevent a revival of Hasmonean power. Remember, at the end of the last lecture, I explained how in 40 BC, the Parthians had invaded Judea, and they had brought with them the son of Aristobulus II, who they established as a puppet ruler in Judea, and that Herod had come to Judea and bettered him in the military context and killed him and taken the throne from this Hasmonean ruler. So he was very concerned that, being an Edomite by blood, he was not particularly popular among the Jews, and his policies that he followed in Judea were not always very popular. He was afraid that because they were disaffected, they would turn their attentions towards some member of the Hasmonean family and try to support that individual in taking over the throne again. So this was his second major concern, was to prevent this Hasmonean revival. Okay, let's see how the major problems of his reign revolve around his attempts to fulfill these two major objectives. Let's go back to objective number one, his attempt to stay in the good graces of Rome. His first problem arose when in 31 BC, Antony and Octavian, or Augustus, squared off against each other. Antony had been the ruler of Egypt and the Roman East, according to the arrangement that the two of them had reached, is that Octavian or Augustus ruled Rome in the West, and Octavian was the ruler in the East. What did I say? That didn't sound right. Octavian or Augustus ruled Rome in the West, and Antony ruled Rome, Egypt in the East. Egypt in the East. Antony had fallen captive to the wiles of Cleopatra in a very interesting fashion. I might digress long enough to tell you how this came about. Is that after Octavian's adopted father, Julius Caesar, had been assassinated, this goes back to 44 BC, Antony and Octavian opposed the ringleaders of the plot that had led to the assassination of Caesar. And naturally, this was a struggle for control of the empire. Would the assassins of Caesar win militarily and retain control of the empire, or would Antony and Octavian win and therefore divide up the empire as they pleased? Naturally, in Rome, all the people that hoped to profit from this situation had to put their money down on one group or the other. They had to commit themselves to one side or the other. The problem was even more acute among the leaders of what were called allied states, because they maintained their independence as long as they were loyal to the Roman leadership. The problem was, now there were two possible Roman leaderships. They couldn't be loyal to both when they're fighting each other. They'd have to take their pick and hope that the ones they picked to back won, because if they lost, they would lose too. And so this was a very difficult situation. Well, most people sized up the situation and looked at it this way. Among the assassins of Caesar were several seasoned, very capable generals. Antony, who had long been an associate of Julius Caesar, his strongest accomplishments were not on the battlefield, but in the brothels of Rome. Octavian was only 17 years of age and had never held a military command in his life. And so people looked at the racing forms, and they saw the playboy and the callow youth on one side and these experienced generals on the other. And they said, well, at least in this case, we don't have to worry about making a wrong choice. And at least all the rulers in the eastern part of the empire backed the assassins of Caesar. But I think you know your general history well enough to know that they lost, and that Antony and Octavian won. Consequently, these rulers in the east were, of course, expecting the worst. they had picked the wrong side, they had lost, now they would have to pay the piper. Well, Octavian and Antony were not so much interested in blood. They were more interested in money. And so Antony was assigned the job of making a grand tour of these allied states in the east and forcing people to ransom their lives by paying over handily on the spot to him. And then he graciously allowed them not only to live, but also to continue to rule their countries as allies of Rome. And so Antony was making his way through Asia Minor and down into Syria and growing wealthier all the time. And he arrived in Egypt because Cleopatra, the ruler of Egypt, had of course backed the wrong people also. And so he ensconced himself in the palace in Alexandria, in the throne room, which was empty because Cleopatra had been elsewhere in the south of Egypt at the time. And he issued orders commanding her to appear. And he waited. And he waited. And he waited, growing increasingly more angry and frustrated as time went on. Eventually, word came to him that Cleopatra was indeed coming. And she was coming, as one does in Egypt, by ship on the Nile, or by barge, I would say. And she was on her way, would be there in a few days. Well, he continued to hold court in the palace in Alexandria, awaiting her arrival and expecting her, of course, to prostrate herself before him like everybody else, beg for her life, and pay handsomely for the privilege of receiving it. Well, her barge arrived in Alexandria and tied up at its wharf, and he continued to wait. And gradually he began to notice that the crowd around him at the court began to seem a little bit thin. People seemed to be disappearing from the audience chamber. Not all in a mass, but a few people gone, a few more gone, a few more gone, until the absence of many of the courtiers was very noticeable. And he asked somebody, "What is going on?" And he found out that Cleopatra was still on her barge at the wharf, but her very suitable and attractive attendants were out sunning themselves on the deck of the barge, and this was providing quite an attraction for the male portion of the city. And that explained the absence. Before long, Octavian was furious. He had not only been made to wait by somebody who stood to lose her life, but had been humiliated. And so he collected his personal guard, stormed down to the waterfront, stormed aboard the barge, and after spending dinner with Cleopatra and the knight, in the morning bestowed at least half of all the wealth he had secured in the East on her, reconfirming her hold on Egypt without any question. Antony not only continued to remain in Egypt where he administered the East, but eventually divorced his Roman wife and married Cleopatra. So now in 31 BC, Antony and Cleopatra are struggling with Octavian for control of the Roman Empire. Now, Herod, as ruler of Judea, was of course responsible most directly to Antony. And indeed, Antony had been very good to him. He had been very generous with him. And so Herod had no qualms about supporting Antony. However, unfortunately for Herod, Antony and Cleopatra lost. Antony committing suicide, I believe, by running himself through with a sword, and Cleopatra committing suicide by allowing a poisonous snake to bite her. But there's even one more act before that came about, too. Cleopatra was an interesting person. We'll come to that later. Anyway, Herod was in a pickle. He had backed the wrong side. And word reached him that Octavian, coming to the east to settle scores, was not willing to be bought off with money. Indeed, Cleopatra tried to beguile him in a manner in which she had similarly beguiled Antony. And when she tried to bat her eyelashes, false or otherwise, I don't know, at Octavian, He took one look at her and he said, forget it. Turned her down flat. That's when she went and had the snake bite her. She had no other choice. She preferred that rather than being dragged in a chariot behind, rather dragged in chains behind Octavian's chariot as he made his triumphal progress through Rome. She wasn't about to subject herself to that. So Herod heard about what happened to Cleopatra. Even more disturbing, the rulers of several of the client states that had backed Antony and had presented themselves to Octavian, begging for mercy. All their pleas for mercy had been rejected and they'd all been executed. And now the summons came for Herod to appear. Herod went. He had no choice. And this is where I think you can see the courage in the man, as well as something of his genius. He appeared before Octavian. He bowed respectfully, but he did not fall on the floor and grovel. He did not beg for his life. He stood there with his legs apart, and he said in a loud voice, I am here because I supported Antony in his recent war against you. And I am proud to say that not only did I support him, but unlike others who began deserting him when they heard he lost the naval battle at Actium, I remained his loyal supporter until I heard he was dead. If you keep me in my position as king of Judea, that's the kind of loyalty you can expect. Very brilliant maneuver. He took what looked like a liability and turned it into an asset. His liability had been that he had been loyal to Antony and not Octavian. But he turned it into an asset by appealing to Octavian on the grounds that, unlike others whose loyalties depend on the shifting flows of power, once I commit myself to somebody, I'm his supporter through thick and thin. That is my record. And that's what I offer you. The same kind of loyalty that will never be withdrawn, certainly not in your moment of danger. And Octavian sat there on that throne and stroked his chin and had to admit that that was a point. And so he confirmed Herod as king of Judea, and Herod continued to rule. So as I said, the man did have courage and he did have quick wit. And the ability to turn what would have been a grave liability into an asset. And we turn to his second major concern, which was to prevent a revolt that would put a member of the Hasmonean family on the throne. We can see again that though we would not approve of his methods or of his means or even of his goals, perhaps, he certainly pursued them with great intelligence. In order to make himself more acceptable to the people, he married a Hasmonean princess, as you see on your chart, your genealogical chart. He married Mariamne, who was a Hasmonean princess. But he was still struck with a difficulty in that, as an Edomite, he could certainly not serve as high priest as well as king. He would have to appoint someone as high priest. Now, he had no need to reappoint Hyrcanus II, because when the Parthians had invaded Judea in 40 BC, when Hyrcanus had been the ruler, at the instruction of his nephew, the Parthians had cut off his ears, and he'd been taken into exile in Parthia. And you might say, well, that's kind of gruesome. Why did his nephew, Aristobulus II, order Antigonus, why did he order the Parthians to cut off his uncle's ears? Well, what does it say in Scripture about an individual who is blemished? Exactly. In other words, this was Antigonus's way of making sure that there would be no comeback as far as the high priest's office for his uncle. This was rather brutal, but he was at least very direct. So Hyrcanus is still alive, but he's in Babylon, where he had been taken by the Parthians. The likely candidate, the natural candidate for the high priesthood was whom? If you look at your genealogical chart, who was the natural candidate? His brother-in-law, Aristobulus III. But, you see, Herod was unwilling to appoint him, because if he had a Hasmonean as high priest, which, remember, was a very influential office as far as the people of Judea were concerned, he could become a focus of discontent, and the people might try to stir up a rebellion that would have its objective as putting Aristobulus in as the civil ruler also. And so he did not want to appoint Aristobulus. So claiming that Aristobulus was too young, which was at least moderately true, he was still a teenager, he imported a priest from Babylon of no particular distinction and installed him as high priest. Notice again that the high priesthood is something which is subject to control by the civil ruler. An appointment, you see. Well, this didn't suit very well with the people of Judea, and within a few years he could see it wasn't going down too well. And so Herod had to bow to sort of public pressure and appoint Aristobulus as the high priest. Of course, he was very reluctant to do this because it was a real political threat to him. But as usual, Herod had a plan for taking care of such a problem. Aristobulus had a birthday coming up. And Herod had a magnificent palace which he had built down near Jericho that featured among not only its accoutrements things like a hot room and a cold room and a tepid room, as was typical in a Roman bathhouse, but he also had an enormous swimming pool. I mean, enormous by our standards. I think the pool that we saw there was probably as big as the college pool. Probably as big as the college pool, which he had down there near Jericho. And anyway, he said to Aristobulus, he says, "Why, look, your birthday's coming up. Why don't you take some time off and go down with some of your friends and enjoy yourself at my palace? I will provide sufficient food and wine and minstrels and dancers and other entertainers that you can have a really good time with yourself and your friends there and enjoy your birthday." And Aristobulus thought this was rather nice of his brother-in-law, and he took him up on his suggestion and merrily went off down to Jericho. And you can imagine the horror and the sorrow with which Herod received the bad news a few days later, that Aristobulus, apparently after having eaten too much and maybe imbibed too much, had gone swimming in the pool and had unfortunately drowned. This was a very sad thing. And so the body was brought back, and a weeping Herod saw to its burial, and thus ended one threat to his rule. I leave it to you to decide whether the drowning was an accident or not. Historians tend to doubt it. Later in his life, he began to be concerned about Hyrcanus off there in Babylon. Hyrcanus might have been ineligible to serve as high priest, but he certainly could become civil ruler of Judea. There was nothing that would block him from achieving that office. And so what he did is he wrote a letter to Hyrcanus. And you have to remember the kind of man Hyrcanus was, you know, his capabilities. And he wrote to him something like this: "Why do you stay in Babylon, so far away from all those that love you and who you love? Here I am, king of Judea. Your granddaughter is my wife, and we have children whom you have never seen. Why don't you come back from Babylon and enjoy the hospitality of my palace? And let us all give you the honor that is due to you as senior statesman of Judea. Perhaps your life has taken an unfortunate turn as a result of what the Parthians did to you, but at least you can live in honor among your own people and enjoy your family in your declining years. And Hyrcanus thought that was very nice of Herod, and so he packed up his things and he came back. Now, this event happened shortly before the civil war between Octavian and Antony. And when the war broke out, of course, Herod was backing Antony. But Herod had one of his friends get chummy with Hyrcanus. And this friend periodically reminded Hyrcanus of the great days when he had ridden at the head of a relief column and saved Julius Caesar's life and been richly rewarded by Julius Caesar. Now, if Hyrcanus could rise to the occasion and he could become an ally of Octavian and assist him in winning out over Antony, certainly Octavian would be as generous as his father Julius had been. And Octavian, once he won, since Herod was backing Antony, once Octavian won the battle, he would certainly get rid of Herod and put Hyrcanus back in as king of Judea. And Hyrcanus thought, well, you know, that makes sense. You know, that sounds very logical. But he said, well, how can I go about this? You see, being the ninny that he was, he couldn't even figure out how to go about it. And so the friend said, I tell you what, it would seem very unusual if you left Jerusalem at this time. But write a letter pledging your support to Octavian and telling him that you will work behind the scenes to subvert Herod and his support for Antony. And I will carry it to Octavian for you. And so Hyrcanus thanked him warmly, sat down and wrote this magnificent letter, and gave it to this, quote, friend. And naturally, the furthest the letter traveled was to Herod. And then Herod had the very disagreeable task of convening a trial at which Hyrcanus had to stand trial on charges of treason. I mean, after all, he had no choice. Can a man who is king of a country tolerate treason even when it comes from within his own family? I mean, this would be dereliction of duty. And he just asked his wife to understand, and the people to understand, that there was no personal animosity towards Hyrcanus, but what else could he do? And so I think we can read between the lines. This friend of Herod's, who became a confidant of Hyrcanus, was obviously doing so on Herod's orders. All this talk filling Hyrcanus's mind with the great old days and the relationship he used to enjoy with Caesar's family. The idea that Hyrcanus should declare himself a secret ally of Octavian in the midst of the civil war between Antony and Octavian. The actual committing of his loyalty to Octavian in writing. All of this was Herod's planning. Just so he could stand there in court before the judges and say, honorable judges, what else can I do? Here is the letter. It is on its face treasonous. Have I any choice but to order his execution? And of course the judges would say, of course not. And so Hyrcanus was executed. His wife, his mother-in-law, and his sons that he executed later in his life at periods of time when he seemed about to die, and it seemed that they were acting precipitously, let me say, in trying to seize power, or at least he was led to believe so. As I said, he was paranoid about holding on to power, and anyone that seemed to threaten him, potentially or actually, he rapidly removed via execution, or in the case of Aristobulus, by assassination. Not a very admirable man. What about his accomplishments? Among his accomplishments, number one, we should note that because of his capable rulership, which from the Roman point of view, what was the bottom line? How did they weigh a ruler as being capable or incompetent? Neil? Right. Judea remained quiet, stable, and loyal. That was the bottom line. And as a consequence, Herod managed to keep Judea independent. And that was no mean accomplishment. Because in the period of time when Judea remained independent under Herod's rule, many other states in the Near East became Roman provinces, losing their independence. The fact that he succeeded in pleasing the Romans well enough that he could keep Judea independent was a significant accomplishment. Because of his loyalty and effectiveness, the Romans increased the borders of Judea until the size of Judea was as large as it was in the days of Solomon. So that you can mention as another of his accomplishments. But as a result of his proven loyalty and efficiency, the borders of Judea were extended by the Romans to the limits of the border of Solomon. And naturally, this put something very important into his control, which was trade routes, which greatly increased the prosperity of the kingdom. Number three, Herod was one of the most significant builders in the entire Near East in the Roman period. One of the most significant builders in the entire Near East during the Roman period. He not only built the temple in Jerusalem, but he built a temple in honor of Augustus in Samaria. Now, this was a temple to the god Augustus, which he built in Samaria. The Samaritans had no compunction about worshiping Augustus as a god. They had always been very willing to compromise their religious beliefs depending on the winds of political change, which is something that also helped to make them detested by the Jews. He built the magnificent city of Caesarea. As you can tell from the name itself, Caesarea, it was built in honor of Augustus. A truly beautiful Roman city, as Roman as Rome itself, with a magnificent chariot race course, magnificent amphitheater, magnificent forum, magnificent marketplace, many beautiful buildings built out of marble. Herod also built many major buildings, law courts, gymnasia, bathhouses, temples, in the surrounding countries. Most of these buildings he paid for himself, even when they were built in foreign countries. It was an act of generosity towards his neighbors. You might say, well, why? Why was he so generous in not only building these fine facilities for other countries, but also paying for it? Why did he build this magnificent city of Caesarea? Surely that was part of pleasing the Romans, but seemed an extreme way of doing it. Why did he build this temple in Samaria and the temple in Jerusalem? Because Herod sought immortality. He wanted to be remembered. And he felt that if he left all these magnificent monuments behind him, he would be remembered. And the thing was, is these buildings were not only beautiful, but in many of them, he played the leading role in terms of designing them, as he had with the temple in Judea. And so, summing up Herod, we have an interesting portrait of a man. A man who was cruel, mainly because he was driven by feelings of paranoia, that he would lose his hold on power. But a man who had unusual abilities in knowing how to use power. A man who had great personal courage, especially at the most dangerous point in his life. And a man who had unusual artistic and architectural ability and taste. And so that's why, at least in terms of historians, when they look at the general history of the world, they do call Herod, Herod the Great. Because although the man leaves us a lot to be desired, his accomplishments at least secure the admiration of historians. And next time we're going to talk about the political conditions of Judea as they existed in the days of Jesus, which is very important, because without understanding those conditions, we will later be less able to understand what was going on at the time that Jesus was arrested and tried. Now, I know some of you have heard this in Big Sandy, I think, in the Life and Teachings class. I'm curious how many have heard that. I know you were there that year, but not that many. So it'll be sort of a repeat for you, but for most, I think it'll be new.